very special guest who contributed a lot to various fields in physics. He said his work on quantum field theory, on particles, particles, photons, electrons, and things like this. Later on, he moved to other fields like chaos, nonlinear dynamics, fractals. And have you ever seen a paper which was quoted more than 1,600 times? Here it is. Only 4 pages, characterization of strange attractors by Grasberger and Boccaccia. So many of you who know something about fractals, it's a very well-known algorithm to compute, to estimate the dimensionality of a set. So it's just because of this paper. So I can go through. And now they will learn about new development in complexity, because Grasberger will tell us how to measure complexity.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction. Thank you for the invitation. Actually, I will give a review over what happened during the last 20 years or so. And I will also mention newer results, but rather critically. The problem is, I would say, today we have 3 major frontiers of physics. The small, which means the particles, the strings, and so on. The large, cosmology, and you know, of course, that there are some connections. So this is, of course, not strictly separated. And the third, I would say, is really the complex. And the prime example of a complex system is, of course, life. So you are complex. Now, the traditional view is that complex systems are just complicated. That is, if you want to understand a complicated system, well, you go to the specialist. And that's why there are chemistry, that's why there are biologists, that's why there are historians, that's why there are geologists, because a physicist can't, well, contribute them. There is no real theory. There's nothing unified in the study of complicated systems. Now, if that's all, then I wouldn't be here, and then there would be no complex systems groups, there would be no conferences on complex systems, there would be no journals devoted to complex systems. The point is that today, a different point of view is taking more and more ground, and that is, there are systems which are complex without being really complicated. And I want to give just a few examples. The first example is the deterministic chaos, and here I just quote the simplest dynamic system, which is not trivial, which is just the iterating parabola. A is a constant, a real value or complex value, and x is just either real or complex value. So nothing more simple. And if you take the right A, and if you look at the right object, you get, for instance, things like that. This is the Julia set of one of these quadratic maps. Z prime is Z square minus some constant. And if you have a better graphics, and are then, or if you have a copy and can copy from a book, then you can get these things, which definitely you would say these are, in some sense, complex. Or this thing here. And all this came out from this awfully simple thing. Now, another example, which has triggered much of the discussion in this field, is spin glasses. Spin glasses are, well, you don't have exactly what nobody is. It's essentially magnetic atoms located in a random position, and the interaction between them is bending an oscillator away on their distance. That is, when they have a certain distance, it might be that they want to be parallel, and if the distance is a little bit different, then they want to be anti-parallel. And you can imagine, if you have a large sample of that, you can get lots of contradicting influences on one of these things, which people call frustration. And this simple frozen law, so there's not much structure really imposed on this, leads to scaling laws, it leads to hierarchies, namely that you can break up the state space into a essentially a tree, an hierarchical tree, and these are all things which one would naively at least associate with a complex system. Now, to come from science to games, you know that there are some games who, in their definitions, are very complicated. But then there are also games who in the outcome are not less complicated, but or even more, but the rules are very simple. And a good example is the two main board games, chess versus Go. Chess has much more complicated rules than Go. Go, you can write just a half a page or one paragraph, but there is no good computer program for Go because it's just too complex. Now, another thing which has triggered a lot of discussion in this field is the so-called game of life, something which was invented by Conway, but he never, at the beginning at least, published anything. It was all published by Martin Guardian, the Scientific American, and it's a very simple game. It's not a two-people game, just a solitary game, so to say, and it's just played on a square like this with a nine-side neighborhood, and each side can be in two states, either so one or zero, or more correctly, that's what I call life, dead and alive. One is alive, zero is dead. And the rule is extremely simple. If you have more than three living neighbors, then you feel really very uncomfortable, so uncomfortable that you die. If you have less than one or equal one living neighbor, well, it's very lonely, and you die for loneliness. But if you have two or three neighbors, then it's okay. And if an empty site has three neighbors, then it's so good that it gets, that it's perfect. Now, these are simple rules, and, well, if you want to see these things, you just go down, go to Google, type in Game of Life, and then you can download dozens of simulation packages. And, well, these are points and things which are stationary. You justify the rules and you realize they won't move. Not very surprised. But then you have all the things which are periodic. So this is a blinker. Because three sides like that, in the next time step are like that, and then they go back. Now this is already more interesting. This also moves periodically with period four, but after four steps, it has the same shape, but it's shifted. Diagonal. So this is a glider. It moves. Now, if you have gliders, where do they come from? Well, we not only have gliders, we have also cages, spaceships, which are bigger ones. You have spaceships with boats around them, which are even bigger ones. Where do they all come from? Well, from factories or from guns. So they're glider guns. So there are things which pulsate, and every now and then, from the send of a glider. Okay, where do they come from? They come from glider gun factories, which are bigger things which pulsate periodically. And from time to time, they produce a glider gun, and then they themselves move away, and then produce another glider gun, etc. Now, I could go on forever, literally I could go forever, because this never stops, because they have been proven. And what's our sketchy proof is by Conway et al., and a very detailed proof is in this new book by Stephen Wolfram, that life is a universal computer, which means if you put in the right ratio packet, you can produce something at the end, after the thing has settled, which can be interpreted as anything you want. For instance, it can be the proof of Fermat's last theorem. And if Riemann's theorem is right, maybe you can also, if it's right, then you also can produce the proof of Riemann's theorem. Now, but I should say, there are, of course, things which should bring you down a little bit. And the first thing is, if you start randomly with time, and with, let me say, a low density of alive sites, then what happens typically is that first, the complexity, whatever you measure it, so you look at it and you say, oh, beautiful, until about 1,000 time steps, and then you say sorry. Because then the gliders bump into each other, they ruin all the interesting structure, and finally you have blinkers and stable things left over. Now, the other reason why you should be a little bit not too excited about this is the whole thing is not too surprising. There are also other simple things, which you can write down in a simple way, but which can produce awfully complex outputs. Yeah? So, I must confess, I, like many others, also first have seen this beam of light and these other things I have thought. And then, only last, I thought you think, oh God, yeah, of course, why not? Okay, so these were examples which were supposed to show you that you can get complexity without having to go into all the massive details which only a specialist in this field would like to treat. Which means that you can really make a sort of theory. But if you want to do this, then you better, it seems, would like to know what is complexity. Is there an unambiguous, an objective way to rank at least objects, or phenomena, or behavior, or whatever, function, by their complexity? The question is, are you more complex than a bacterium? Can you really, I mean, one would say yes, but is there any way of showing this in an objective way? Now, the situation is really a bit strange, because imagine you would like to determine an X. You were living in the middle or the beginning of 19th century, and you want to determine an X. And you know, okay, there's, well, maybe 18th century. There's hot and cold, but assume that nobody has really made a definite scale for temperatures. So that nobody could tell you, yes, this is more hot and this is less hot. Imagine you would like to do mechanics without being able to rank things by weight or by velocity. And that's essentially where we are in the theory of complex systems. Now, go to the literature, and here I have some quotations from one paper, all from the same paper. It's a well-known author, I don't want to say more. And he starts why systems may be very complex. First, they may have many of elements. So the brain has a lot of neurons, the world has a lot of people, the laser has many photons, and the fuel in cubic centimeter has many molecules. Now, if this is really by itself, then I will say, yes, the fluid is the most complex. But then he goes on, the brain is the most complex. And he has some reason, because obviously what is involved somehow is that the brain is involved with a lot of information. On the one hand, the brain can treat a lot of information, and on the other hand, if you want to describe the brain in a way that you really think you need it if you want to do justice to its complexity, then you have to describe much more than if you have an ideal gas. But all this doesn't is quantitative, and it doesn't bring us to any quantitative conclusion. So the first thing maybe to become quantitative might be that we look at mathematics. And if we open books, we don't have to go to complex numbers, I mean, the square root of minus one. But if we go to something more closely related to this talk here, you really find at least two definitions of complexity. And both in computer science. And the one is the complexity of an algorithm. People can distinguish between time complexity and space complexity. And time complexity is essentially the CPU time which you need to perform an algorithm. Typically, it's used in the way that the input can scale, can be of varying length, so that the instance size can change. And then you ask, how does the CPU time scale with the size of the problem? Now, the other is the space complexity, which measures essentially needed storage memory to do this. Now, so both are related to difficulties to perform some task, and the task is to perform an algorithm. And, okay, this is a nice definition, and I have nothing against it, except that it doesn't apply to objects, you would say. I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist, and I want to describe objects, or behavior of it, but not necessarily algorithms. Maybe associated with these objects are algorithms, and then this might become relevant. But at the moment, what shall I do? The other definition is, there's also the word algorithm, but that's a completely different thing. It's a corner of Chai Ting, algorithmic complexity, or as Chai Ting nowadays prefers to call it, the algorithmic randomness, which already points at one of the problems of this thing for our application. Now, very roughly, how is this defined? U is a universal computer. You might think of your PC, or if you have an Apple, you think of your Apple. So it's something which can do computation of algebraic complexity, of algebraic length, provided you have enough disk space, enough time. And S shall be some string of letters. For instance, the letters of Moby Dick. And then Cu of S, the complexity of S with respect to U, is the length of the shortest program which produces S when put into the computer U, so and stops. So what you have the computer, you take this program, you feed it into your computer, and the computer should produce S and then stop. So that is it. Now, prepare to take the next task. So for instance, as I said, you could be your PC, S could be the text of Moby Dick, and, well, what is the program which produces the text of Moby Dick? It's a compressed file from Moby Dick. Plus, if it's a zip file, the command unzip this file and print this file. So the program for producing Moby Dick consists of length of, I mean of unzip, of LDR, and of the file, the compressed. And so if this compression rate, let me see, is, let me say, 3, so if the compressed file has a third of the length of the original Moby Dick, then the complexity per letter of Moby Dick is a third of what it would be if you would just take the ASCII file. Now, there's one thing which you should notice. If the length of your string goes to infinity, then Cu of S becomes basically essentially dependent of U. And more precisely, for different computers, the Cu of S differ essentially by a constant amount, and this constant amount is essentially the length of an emulation program. So if you have your other favorite computer which you want to use, you just emulate this computer on the PC which is provided to you, and then you're back to the other computer. And so, and the only increase in program length is just emulation. And if S is very long, then this can be neglected, and therefore, we can take the limit as the infinity of the complexity divided by the length as the complexity per letter. And this is the first attempt at the definition of complexity. Now, what are the drawbacks? The main drawback is that if S can be random, if S has any chance to be considered as random, then C of S measures the randomness. The randomness, according to Shannon, is the information needed to specify the object. And that's exactly what we did, the information encoded in the compressed file, for instance. Now, there are, of course, sequences where the notion of randomness doesn't make sense. For instance, this sequence, which I hope you recognize what it is, and this sequence, which we also maybe didn't recognize, and then there's the DNA of not a random person, but of Albert Einstein, which is also not random, because he wasn't a random person.
That's and then... 3.141.
True. Yeah. So yes, man. Good, you recognized it. Perfect, thanks. Ah, I'm happy. Okay. Now, and another, which of course was what these computer people were mostly interested in, a computer code. And computer code is also not wrong. Now, for all these, C of S is a good complexity measure. I'm not objection. But if we are confronted with something which you see in the lab, or which some other experimentalist sees in the lab, then this is not a good thing. Think of the following things.
first.
I have here prepared three figures. Yeah? And I have shown these figures to many people and asked them, what would you consider as the most complex? Now, there were some people who said this. And there wasn't anything. Take it back. And they said, well, we have to be very precise to make this figure. We have to be very careful. Okay. So I dismissed this. So now we have these two. Which is more complex? Well, I would say this one. Now this one looks just random. Looks just dull. Complexity for me is something interesting. Now, of course, this was created by a random number generator. Not really, because it was a single random number. So it's not random. So these are all these subtleties, which I don't want to go now into. But the point is, intuitively, you make this distinction between complex behavior and random behavior. And to illustrate this from daily life, assume you had a Ferrari, a beautiful Ferrari, and you paid much for it because it's a complex car.
How do you know that there's not a pattern in the other one, you just can't see it?
Very good question.
Maybe that's moving.
I come to this point. This is a very good question. So, assume you're a Ferrari, you paid much for it because it's a very complex car. But it has this strange symmetry. The left side looks essentially like the right side. Now, to make it more complex, what do? You take a hammer and smash on it, and then the symmetry is gone, and it's much more complex. Because you need much more information to describe it. And then you break the windshield, and then you. Okay, and you make it more and more complex. Well, maybe you don't like Ferraris, maybe you like to eat beef. So what is more complex, the cow or the ground beef? The cow has all these regularities which help in its description. The ground beef is awfully to describe. So I hope I don't have to say much more. So the conclusion which erased and emerged from this, and which was particularly proposed some 20 years ago by Hong and Huberman, is that complexity should be something which is somewhere located between low randomness, so order, and real big randomness. So you have this somewhat single hump curve. Complexity is between order and chaos, or as the slogan goes, it's at the edge of chaos. Now, I think I definitely agree with this, but definitely I wouldn't take it too literal, as is done in a quite considerable literature, which is still going on, where people just produce a curve which is like that, and say, ah, now I've got a complexity. So what they do, for instance, they take Shannon entropy, and take entropy times maximum entropy, so log of the number of states, minus entropy. So if it's very random, then the second factor is zero. If it's not random, the first factor is zero, and you get a one-hump curve. Of course, this is not what is meant by this curve. Yeah? So all I wanted to say is be aware of some part of the literature there. But now let me come back to whose question was it? Your question. As I said, I'm interested in some real objects. This thing here. Now, when I want to describe it, I never describe it completely. You might say this piece of dust, I don't think. But if I were to describe it, I would have to describe every quark in this damn thing. And exactly at one moment. But this is not what you can, and this is definitely also not what you want to do. And that's why, in statistics and physics, we have this distinction between a macro state and a micro state. And when I say I describe something, I mean actually I describe a macro state, which means I describe an ensemble. And when I come now back to this figure, what I mean when I say that the right-hand side is not complex is something a little bit more tricky. You pointed out correctly that there might be some irregularities hidden here. And since this was a pseudo-random number, there definitely are irregularities. But when I say that this is not random, I say I make a more or less casual look at it. And I say something which looks like that is not complex. So I make implicitly out of this very special object an ensemble for which this is a representative. And then I say that this ensemble is not complex. Yeah? And then it's clear why the notion of algorithmic complexity, without any modification, as it is not very useful. Because it contains a complete description, which is good, as I say, if you want to describe a computer program for some special task, or if you want to describe the blueprints for a house, but you don't want to describe all the atoms, how they sit in the blueprint, but not only. You know what you're talking about, what you're interested in. So this is good when you exactly know what you're interested in, when you exactly know which of the information is object to specify. You can disregard, and which you can keep, which you have to keep. So the second attempt is the complexity is not all the information you need to specify an object, but it's the meaningful information. Now, the problem is, of course, I have not yet said what is meaningful. And as I said, there are cases like a gas, like a single liquid or a crystal, where the distinction between micro and macro variables is obvious. No problem. But then there are these examples, like a brain, where this is far from obvious. Do you want to describe every location of a neuron? Okay. Maybe you want to describe every location of a synapse. There are thousands of synapses per neuron. Or maybe not even that is not enough. Maybe you want to describe how these synapses, how strong they are. Maybe all this is relevant. So the point is that in a real complex system, you just don't know where to draw the border between micro and macro. Now, you can also view it from another point of view. Very often it is said, a prototype of a complex system is one which has hierarchies. Now, I agree with that to some extent, because a hierarchy means that you don't have just two layers, you have several layers, and you can get a distinct probability distinction here, or here, or here. But you can easily make a hierarchy more complex by making it tangled, what people call tangled. So think, for instance, of an absolutely democratic society, which is simple. Think of an absolutely hierarchical society, the workers, the next layer, the next layer, the next layer, the president. Okay. And you can make this tangent by having the president love his wife, and his wife having a lover who's down there. And then you have all sorts of the hierarchy is broken, and the whole thing becomes definitely more complex. Problems over problems. Now, let me just switch the subject, and let me say a few words about channel theory, because this will become necessary. In channel theory, an object is a random variable, essentially. That is, it has probability assignment. So for each outcome of each object, you can, you have a probability pi, and then the entropy is this famous formula, minus pi log pi. And this is essentially the average information needed to specify which object you're looking at. And if the probabilities for an object are essentially equal, then the entropy is large, and if there's one probability which dominates everything else, then h is small. I think this is, I guess, well known. Now, the main thing which has led to alternative formulations of information theory during the last case is the channel completely disregarded the information needed to specify the APIs. He says, I have a two-step procedure. On the one hand side, I get the probability distribution. And I get these numbers PI. And I don't count this as information yet. And then I use this PI to encode optimally, like for instance, you know, in the Morse alphabet, yeah, they are short, symbols for an E, because E is very frequent, and other letters which are less frequent are encoded more complicated. So you can use the probabilities to make an optimal encoding so that the information is really minimal. So you need these probabilities, but you don't include them in your information. Now, one guy, for instance, among the ones who most vigorously proposed an alternative, it was Jormar Rissanen, and he said, no, total information should include the specification of your probabilities. Now, this is a certain problem, namely, if I specify probability is a real number, I need infinitely many digits. But of course, I don't need infinitely many digits for my coding, because some rough guess will be sufficient. But on the other hand, so if I have only few objects, so if I use these probabilities only once for some very short message in the sense or for one very short thing, then it's sufficient to have a rough guess. But if I want to use it again and again and again and again, I better spend some more time in getting more precise estimates of PI, and then the total information in all my messages might become smaller. And what he finds is not only that the number of digits per probability should depend on the length of the object, but he also can give how they should depend. And if you have really smooth distributions, then essentially the number of digits should increase logarithmically with the information content of what you want to describe. And the whole theory is then called the minimum description length theory. And it's a nice thing. And one thing which you can, I think, guess already is that if n describes how many objects you want to characterize, how many messages you want to load, the length of the message, or n, if you think again in terms of a sequence of letters, what is the length of this sequence which you want to describe, where for each letter you have your probability, then the total information, so the minimum description length needed, is a convex function. You see, here, you haven't yet known enough about the probabilities. So here, you essentially encode letter by letter. Here, you have already learned much about statistics. And here, now, the increase is much softer. This sort of curve is essentially appears in each variant of information. Here I have it for this minimum description length, but you can do the same, you get this qualitative with the same behavior if you look at algorithmic complexity. Also there, if you have a longer string, so if you have, for instance, a concatenation of two short strings, S1 and S2, then the length to describe the compressed signal is less than the compressed signals for both of them. Of the sum. And it's the same also for channel entropy, if you disregard this information for them. Also there, if you have what is called block entropy, essentially the entropy needed to characterize a block of length n in a very long string, and if you have a Markov chain, then this would be essentially a straight line, or even if it's independent. And actually, for a realistic case, you have this convex curve. And the important thing, the most important thing I would say, is this offset here, which I would call respective measure complexity, and which measures, in some sense, how, I mean, the amount of correlations in this thing. Because it measures when you have a long block, how much you can make use of regularities in this long block to shorten its most efficient, you know, most economic description. So for general entropy, we have the same thing. And in all these theories, you can now, in all these variants, define something which is the information for the first part of the object, plus the information for the second part of the object, minus information for the joint. And call this mutual information. And this is a non-negative thing, which is zero only, when the two parts are independent. And I don't want to go into this here, but I should say mutual information is very useful for a lot of things, but here I want just to come with my third attempt, namely, complexity is somehow some mutual information or some mutual information average. I mean, the point is, you see, you have to split your object into two halves in order to talk about it. And you can do this in various ways. You can do various averages over different ways of splitting. And therefore, there is quite considerable literature about this. And it started, I think, with Rob Shaw, and he went on in the late 70s or early 80s, and it goes on essentially up to now, where people propose this in one form or another. And essentially, what this says is an object is complex if this difference is large, so if the whole thing is different from the sum of its parts. And this, I think, embodies what people often say. An object is complex if the whole thing is not just the sum of its parts. Now, once we're here, we can scratch our head and say, maybe it's more general. Here we say there are correlations between different parts of the object. But maybe there's also, what if the correlation between an object and its environment? And I think this also contributes to what we naively or intuitively call complex. Shakespeare's works are complex because there is something in the environment outside the books which can interpret this. If there were no humans, I mean, this is the problem of Satan. Yeah? If you don't know that there's an information, if there's no machinery for reading it, if there's nothing in the environment which corresponds to it, then you would call it complex. And obviously, something is complex, it can do meaningful tasks. Also, this means it fits somehow meaningfully in its environment and do something. Okay, but obviously, I'm not following this here because these are things which are, I don't know at all how to quantify these, and that's essentially what I want to do. So, just if you one remark, among this list of people who did this was, for instance, Tononi et al., and they were brain scientists, or are brain scientists, and they were interested in the complexity of patterns in the brain. And the brain is typically something which is interconnected a lot and on different scales. And so their philosophy was, you make a partitioning, a binary partitioning, all possible, and which means, of course, they never worked on real data with it, but they could play on models for this. And they got, I think, quite interesting results, which I don't want to go into detail. What I want to go into detail is the opposite. Not something which is highly interconnected, but something which is one-dimensional, a string. And in particular, a time series. So you have something measured as a function of time. And the partitioning which I'm talking now about is, of course, the one into past and future. And once you do this here, then you realize that you have some connection with forecasting. That is, you can talk about the complexity of the forecast, and the complexity of the forecast is indeed related to the complexity of this mutual information which we have discussed before. But before I do that, I have to say, by forecast, I mean, I am here, and then I say in the next step, not only what can happen, but I try to give as precise probabilities as possible. So I want to say, today was the weather like that. Tomorrow, with 90%, it will be sunshine. With 9%, it will be rain. And with 1%, there might be hail or snow or whatever. And with 0.1%, maybe the world is big. Anyway. So, easy one-dimensional system. Well, time system just contains zeros and ones. If it's just 1, 1, 1, obviously it's easy to forecast. If it's 1, 0, 1, 0, there are easy to forecast. Now you would say, if something is completely random, it's hard to forecast. And I would say, no. If something is really completely random, it's very easy to forecast. I just take my coin and flip it. One, etc. It's as good as any other forecast. I also could say 1, 1, 1, 1 is also as good as any other. A difficult forecast is when you have non-trivial patterns. So what we should distinguish here is the difficulty of a forecast from the quality of a forecast. Yeah? So to take this quadratic map here, a less than 1.4, periodic is easy. A equal 2 is completely random. Is again, a good forecast is impossible. But the best within this restriction is easy. It's a guess. And the same we can say, what about the weather forecast? We can ask ourselves, how good is the weather forecast? And how difficult is it? Do we really need a massive supercomputer? Or can we just buy very simple means? Okay, why can a forecast be difficult? Well, the main reason why a forecast might be difficult is because you have to remember a lot about the past. If there's no connection to the past, no correlation between future and past, then a forecast is easy. But if there are long-range correlations, then this is the most difficult one, because then you have to store the information for a long time and reuse it and get it back again. And, well, you can formulate all this rather precisely, and you can define what is called the forecast information complexity, which is essentially the average information, average as you move in time, about the past, which you have to store at any moment to be able to make an optimal prediction for the future. And you can show that this forecasting complexity is bounded, is an upper bound to this effective measure complexity, to this offset in this channel curve. So this is a typical precise result which you can get. And as the last thing, maybe, I want to go to a very deep concept, namely logical depth. This is the concept which was coined by Charles Bennett, which many of you might know here. And he came back to this algorithmic complexity thing. But he said, I'm not interested in the length of the shortest code to produce a string S. But let me assume that the shortest description of X on a computer U is, well, less than that program. And then I ask myself, what is the CPU time I need to decode from this description the real object S? That's a difficult, yeah? So the algorithmic complexity was essentially difficult to store the information. The logic is that this is the difficulty to use it and to decode from it. And I want to discuss two examples, one a more formal one and one a very informal one, and the informal one is life. Real life. Being. And it's a very informal thing, of course, but roughly you can say we all believe that life had no explicit proof. It started somehow. Yeah, well, but it took an awfully long time, a couple of billion years, on a huge parallel computer called Earth, to develop its complexity. Now a more formal one is a cellular automaton, and this is a really amazing thing.
To think about it.
It's a cellular automaton found by Steve Wolfram. It's one of his simple things. It's a one-dimensional dynamic system. Space is in this direction, time goes in this direction, and each site on this one-dimensional string can be either 0 or 1. And there's a rule encoded in this left-hand side, how do you go from a local pattern of 0 and 1s to the next site. So for instance, if it's 1, 1, 1, you can write 0 and go to the next. If it's 1, 0, 0, you write 1. If it's 0, 0, 0, you write 0 and so on. And let me start with all zeros, except a single one in the middle. Say, well, it's simple. What can come out of that? And you run it. And what you run is this figure. And here you see quite some stronger regularities. Here also, less clear. But now look at the central column. And people have done this on much larger scale, up to millions. And it seems to be completely random. In the same sense that the digital pi are random. The mathematician would call it normal. So this is a very strange thing, how you started from something which has no randomness at all, and something which seems to be quite random. And since it seems to be quite random, there is no known shortcut to produce this sequence, except for really simulating the damn thing. So to get a sequence of length n, you have to simulate a square region with n squared. What am I doing? Sorry. Thank you. So this is, unless somebody finds a shortcut, an example of one of these logically deep systems. Now, let me now see how this logical depth is related to. Okay. Forecasting complexity. And for that, I just discussed shortly a general strategy to encode optimally some string. S is a string, and S, this might be, for instance, integers. So let's out of it or something like that. And you want to describe this sequence with a minimal information, and what you do is the following. You start off, and you know nothing, so you read it as zero, and you store it. And then you know really a little bit about the system. Maybe what it was at time zero. So you have some guesses about the system, and you can make some predictions for S1. So when you read S1, you're not completely surprised, but you know already something. So what you store is just the additional information which you need in addition to what you knew already about it. So in average, this will be a little bit less than what you have to store here. And then you go on. With this information, now you predict this too. Since you have now two time steps, you can predict this too a little bit better. You read it, and you fill up the information which was lacking, and you store that. And if you now add up at the end all these informations, if your prediction was always optimal, you end up with an optimal encoding. Now, what does this do? An optimal decoding, of course, is that you forecast, you supply your stored information from your notebook, and you decode it. So what you see is, if the forecasting was difficult, then it also takes a lot of time to encode it. And then code and decode means that it was difficult to create the object for the choice description. So the forecasting complexity in this thing here sets a lower limit on the logic depth. And I should say, you can't expect more than a lower limit, because there are just some rather general things. Namely, the first thing is, if you look at the algorithm complexity, then since there is no algorithm, can't be, I mean, this is related to Turing's Hopping problem, there can't be any algorithm. Universal rule for finding a shortest program, so there cannot only be, I mean, you only can get upper bounds on the CU of S, and from that you can show that you never know whether there is a shorter program which would be then more difficult to code, so you only can put lower limits on the computer, on the depth. Okay, so let me summarize. Essentially, what we have arrived at is that complexities can be related to tasks. And there are various tasks if you are confronted with objects. The first, the object is an algorithm. And then you want to perform this algorithm. And this gives you the space and time complexity of the algorithm. The next thing is the object could be a string. And then the task could be to store or retrieve or transmit the shortest description. And this gives you the call of type decomplexity. Or if you put some restriction on your method, you end up with some more technical things like level zip complexity, which I didn't talk about, but there are lots of variants. Now, the next thing is probably to be to take the short code and decode it. And this gives the logical depth, and this is completely related to forecasting complexity, as we saw. And it is related to the range and strength of mutual correlations measured via mutual entropies. Now, these things I haven't discussed it formally, and I don't want to discuss it formally here. So let me go back and go forward immediately to the last two points on this list. And this thing here is, it sounds very similar to what we did before, but it isn't. Find shortest code. It is, how do you find it? How do you, what that means essentially, how do you understand it? What means understanding something? Understanding means something, means essentially that you replace a naive and lengthy and inefficient description by an efficient, shorter one, by either realizing that there are iterations between the parts, so you make use of correlations, or you relate it to something which you have already seen before, so you use relations to the environment. Then it's find the shortest, and that is closely, most closely related to understand the meaning. And as far as I know, there's no attempt, and I don't know how to do it, to somehow formalize the difficulty of this, because this is typically done intuitively and typically done completely hazard. And the last thing on my list is I go one step back and I say, I now want to define what is the real complexity. And that seems to be, and to say which systems are really complex. That is, again, something which I think is very complex. I have no theory for that either, of course.
Thank you very much for this talk on complex issues. So let's open it up for discussion.
So on, I guess it was the previous slide, where you were talking about the, you could only get lower bounds.
Yeah.
So I guess I didn't understand that argument. I mean, in order for, say, the Homomorphic complexity defined uniquely, you have to specify some kind of standard Turing machine that's decoding it, right?
Which Turing machine is not relevant. The point is, you never know whether there isn't a shorter algorithm which produces the same string, but it runs so long that you can't wait. I mean, let me put it this way. You could say, let me take Moby Dick, and I want the shortest description of Moby Dick on my computer. Moby Dick has about 1 million characters. So I only have to check all compressed programs up to length 1 million. And if I have zip at hand, I first zip it, and then I know the zipped Moby Dick is 200,000 or 300,000. Then I don't have to search programs longer than 20,000. So you'll see, very simple, I find my shortest program by checking all programs shorter than 200,000. And then Turing comes up from his grave and says, no. Because what will happen is, from time to time, you will encounter an input, and you sit in front of your computer, and it works, and it works, and it works, and it works, and it doesn't stop. And then you don't know whether this is a good program, a good code. So there is no algorithm to find the shortest code for an object. So you're never sure whether you don't find the shorter one. So if you thought that this is the shortest code and found a clever trick to decode from it, this would all be superseded. Once you find the shorter code, then you have to start from zero again. And so really, even the lower bounds are not really computable. I mean, the upper bounds are not computable at all. But even the lower bounds are, I think what I wrote is wrong. What I want to say is, the point is that my forecasting is one particular way of coding. And I have no real proof that it gives the shortest code. There's no real proof that the sequential coding is optimal. I mean, people believe that sequential coding is more or less optimal, but as far as I know, there's no real proof for that. And so within the class of this forecast, this seems to be more or less optimal, and then I have a lower bound for the logic. Yeah? But you shouldn't take this to a literal.
Other questions?
I have two questions. One is on that picture that you had with three examples, and you were saying which is more complex. Now, I believe the two that you were interested in are Poincaré sections.
Yes.
Corresponding to the
standard
of some simple system.
Yes.
And the one in the middle is presumably some quasi, the motion described is.
This is a coarse grained standard.
Some kind of quasi periodic motion of some system, and the other one is the chaotic. Now, I would have said the chaotic motion is more complex.
Well, that is exactly.
So I was wondering, why did you, how did you go about the? Which brings out the fact that it's context dependent, presumably, what you name as being more complex and less complex. You can't tell sort of just by looking. Do you agree with that?
There's one thing, of course. I think I first should more precise what you say. You say chaotic. I mean, there are chaotic things which are very much structured and chaotic, which are not. For instance, this logistic map, this program, at x prime is 2 minus x squared, or it's 4 times x times 1 minus x. This is completely random. So if you make a binary partitioning, you say a symbol 1, if it's right of the maximum, a symbol 0, if it's left of the maximum, then this 0, 1 string is completely random. No structure. While there are other chaotic systems which have structure. Now, I guess what you meant is really chaotic, but disregard any structure.
Yeah.
And then comes the point. If it's just chaotic, like this fully developed Carolingian music map, x prime is 2 matrix x squared. You say it's random. I mean, many people would say that something which is random is less complex. And that was the case with this Ferrari, where I say you can make it arbitrarily more complex by just making it more random. And this, now, I don't know, but I guess you're a mathematician. And the mathematicians are, in general, in favor of
randomness being more complex. Well, natural scientists are usually in favor of complexity being somewhat related to interpretable or meaningful or structure. And that means that we would say, I mean, actually, this was made by a pseudo-random number generator, but you are right, I could have obtained it just by the Baker transformation, so that's something else. The point is that we would like to say, and you can debate this, that something which is just random is dull and is, there's not much to be learned from it, and it's not complex. I mean, and I'm not the only one who says so.
Well, I don't mean to criticize
you. No. I mean, this is, I mean, the point is, you see, I'm leader of a complex system, or was leader of a complex systems group, research group. And the people who call this complex systems research definitely didn't want us to study random systems. Yeah? I mean, there are journals called complexity. They're always interested in chaotic things. But chaotic things which are also structured like this. Yeah? But if they are structured like this, then.
Well, that leads me to my second question, which again is not meant in a critical way, but I'm trying to explore as to your beliefs. You said at the beginning that this field is in the position in which mechanics would be before you have a measure of mass and the thermodynamics without temperature. But I mean, my guess, just from listening to what you said, and I may be totally wrong, is that what you'll get out of this is some more efficient, if you can do a good measure of complexity, you'll get faster decryption of encoded messages or stuff like that. I don't see what you'll get out of it.
Well, that would be something, hopefully.
Sure, the military would give you a problem. but I'm just interested, what do you see as sort of, if really you strike it rich, what would you get out of this? Getting a good definition of complexity.
Very good question. Which means I have no good answer. Now, one thing which maybe I wanted to say is science often proceeds by taking an intuitive notion and cutting the ends and narrowing it down. So when we talk about force, we don't talk about the force of a personality. Yeah. And so very often we use in science concepts which derive from daily life concepts, which are much narrowed and applied to a narrow field. And what I would say is there are certainly things where you can do this also with the notion of complexity. What I think is very hard to find something which covers all the facets, all with this. The connotation with what we naively think when we should complete. But within your sub field, you can do this, and there is a tension in, for instance, complexity of an algorithm, it's a perfect thing. And if you are interested in something which is not random, then complexity, Chinese complexity, is a perfect notion of complexity. And some of these forecasting complexities, I mean, you can relate difficult to forecast with a range of correlation, and so on, which might be useful. I don't know of any application, but once again, the point is that you have to zoom in, to cut down to to come from an open-minded view, something which is a little bit more narrow, and then, okay, it's the usual thing in science.
Thank you. Are there more questions?
So at one point you were talking about notions of complexity that were linked to predictability.
Yeah.
And you said something akin to mutual information could measure predictability.
Not predictability, but difficulty.
Right. So
not the possibility, okay, but the right. difficulty.
So that seems odd to me because it seems to me predictability can separate things like deterministic from indeterministic systems.
You talk about predictability, and not I was not talking about predictability. Predictability is the possibility of prediction. I was talking about the ease of prediction. So a series of conflicts is not possible to predict perfectly, but it's easy to predict optimally, namely, just guess it.
So how does the mutual information capture the ease?
Because if the mutual information is high, and if far away things are dependent according to mutual information, that means that if you go along and predict it, if you want to predict this, maybe you need to know what this has been.
Okay,
and you have to use all this information.
Okay, this is why that doesn't make sense to me. Because if you take a periodic system as opposed to a chaotic system, they're both deterministic. In both cases, if I know, if you tell me, starting from no knowledge at all, exactly what the state is at time t, I can then figure out exactly what the state is at some later time. So in terms of mutual information, those two sorts of systems have the very same mutual information to past and future. So the mutual information wouldn't distinguish them. They'd both be one.
No, not exactly. Let me see what you mean. Periodic is obvious. Yeah? You just have to go one step back. Now, chaotic, you have to again say what sort of chaoticity you mean. If you have in mind this system, two minus xn squared, then let me assume you have this in mind. And let me assume you have in mind that you want to predict exactly what exists. And then I say, you are in a problem anyhow, because x is real valued. And for an optimal prediction of x, you have to give infinitely many digits. So you need infinitely much information anyhow. So that's not what you want, I guess. And so what people do is, they make from this what is called symbolic dynamics, which is, they say if xn is less than, in this case, 0, you translate this into sn is minus 1, and if xn is larger than 0, you say sn is plus 1. Xn equals 0 happens with 0 for a reason. And then you try to predict this, at least since you can do with finite information. Yeah? Now, this thing produces a string of S's, which is completely random. That is, I don't have to know anything about the future or about the past. It doesn't help. If, however, I have xn plus 1 is 1.8732. Minus x. And I hope I didn't hit a periodic window. Let's miss you. Then this produces a string of S's which have long range correlations. Which are, so the string of symbols has a positive entropy, but it has also correlations. And to produce, to predict this thing, it's much more difficult.
So it seems then that this notion of ease of predictability really uses mutual information together with a particular kind of coarse grain. So I'm saying in Liouville theorem, I would tell you that the area of phase space is preserved.
The coarse grain, yes.
Is the variance in S preserved?
The coarse graining is necessary if I want to make any information theoretic connection. Because otherwise, all information is infinite. At least with
if you're in a continuous system.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are notions of information for continuous systems, but they are rather exotic.
Yeah.
Okay, last question.
So in this you use rather heavily probability theory, and you also use, for example, ideas of correlation.
But yeah.
The whole discussion seems to be classical. That there are there are analogs of these things.
Purely classical.
For example, entanglement is a kind of correlation.
You have all these clever people here.
Yeah, so I mean, so the question is that adequate for a quantum world, or are people trying to extend it, or how does it fit in? I mean, how does...
You should ask these people.
We don't have a good measure of entanglement either. So.
Yeah.
It's purely classical, thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again. Next week we'll have a talk from Clarkson University in New York, and he will tell us how famous is the scientist, and later on he will discuss theory, society, and diversity in network topologies. And now I would ask you, our guests who came outside the limit, perhaps you would like to take a poster and post it somewhere. I'll be happy to distribute those together.
I am
having
a
face.
Of course! Of course, yes.
I remember the name. And when
face was.
Yeah.
Your face was something. And when you talked, and I a little bit more, but.
Yeah.